And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar, and what a special show we have for you today. We're going to be talking with Shannon Gessling, who is the Executive Director and Chief Legal Counsel for the Southeastern Legal Foundation. She's going to be here to tell us all about her lawsuit to prevent the EPA from regulating CO2 as a pollutant. But first, we're going to be kicking off a new segment today called the Tea Party Book Club. I'm very excited about this. We've got Tea Partiers on the line from Spartanburg, South Carolina, from California, from various cities in Texas. We've invited them to come on today and talk with our guest, Christine O'Donnell, about her new book, Troublemaker. Christine, welcome back to the Tea Party Power Hour. It is an absolute honor to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much, Mark, for having me. You do such important work and talk about such important things on your show, so I'm very glad to be a part of it.
And let me just say it was an honor to meet you in the Woodlands whenever you made a trip through Texas. It was just fantastic listening to you speak and interact with the people who had come to the book signing. I've never seen anyone put quite so much into a book signing. That was great.
Well, that's what I love. You know, I wrote Troublemaker to hopefully inspire and empower people to, you know, continue to bring this message to 2012. So when the folks come out or call in, I'm very grateful, and I love to talk to people and, you know, give them whatever they're asking for, whatever questions they have.
Well, speaking of questions, we've got Stan from the Spartanburg, South Carolina Tea Party on the line. Let's get him on. Stan, can you hear us?
I can. Good morning, Mark and Christine.
Hey, Stan. How are you?
I'm just great. Just great. Let me lead off with a disclaimer. This is the first time I've participated in something along these lines, so please bear with me.
You're doing fine.
And, Christine, of course, I have read your book. I ordinarily would not have bought this book except that I was asked to participate in this. And now I'm glad that I was asked, as these things do work out. Christine, your book is inspiring, and your sharing of your life experiences in particular added to it. When I looked at the book, my first thought was chaotic, because it moved around from place to place, and as I read through the book, it dawned on me that that generally is the way our lives are, and we don't always control them. So just wanted to point out that that's one of the messages I took from your book.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, what I did, I started right off, after the introduction, giving the readers what most of them were picking it up for. You know, they wanted to know all about the infamous ad and, you know, what happened with the internal sabotage. But then in between, and those parts are set apart through italics. And then I started with talking about who I am and what got me involved in politics, and then merged the two by the middle. And I shared so much of, you know, my background, my father being an alcoholic, struggling financially, you know, struggling to pay my college tuition, because so many of us, everyday Americans, average citizens who are not billionaires or incumbents, and these things haven't come easy to us, we've been shut out of the political process. And when I ran for the U.S. Senate, my opponent, both in the Republican establishment side and the Democrats, tried to use it against me that it took me 10 years to pay off my college loans. And these are the sorts of things that most Americans struggle with. And in order to get our country back on track, we need more everyday Americans engaging in the political process, holding our leaders accountable. And I wanted the reader to relate and to feel that, you know, if she can do it, so can I. And then I closed the book with some policy, you know, why big government is wrong, why socialism is wrong, hoping that once the reader felt like, you know, you know, I've been through a lot of that, and I still care about what's going on. I have a voice, that they might feel empowered to step up and get involved, especially going into 2012.
Well, you know, speaking of taking a while to pay things off, my recollection is that Barack Obama accumulated a pile of parking tickets as both a student and a professor at Harvard and didn't pay any of them off until just before he ran for election. So you got your college loans paid off a lot quicker than Barack Obama got his parking tickets at Harvard paid off. You can verify that through the Cambridge Police Department. So I think you did great paying back your college loans. A lot of people, you know, for all the talk about Rick Perry trying to get his driver out of a parking ticket, nobody realizes how many parking tickets Barack Obama would have skipped out on if he didn't think right before the election that maybe it was a good idea to pay those off. So, Stan, do you have anything else for Christine?
Well, no, the other thing that I wanted to point out, and for those listening that have not read the book, actually your closing chapters on activism are spot on. I've just become involved in politics and in the Tea Party movement in the past year, and the things that you bring to the table as someone who wants to make a difference are your voice, your vote, your time, and your money. And those are four things that you have control of. And if you're really serious about making a difference, you need to be free with all of those and use them wisely. And I think that's one thing that you pointed out in your closing chapters as far as advice to us.
Yeah, you know, you're right, Sam. I'm so glad that spoke to you in that way, because when I was on the campaign trail, I talked about some of this in the closing chapters. I would meet people, 50s and 60s, who had never voted before, many not even registered to vote. And it's because there's this false mindset that, you know, I'm not wealthy or smart enough, I'm not part of the political process. And there's an intimidation factor in, well, now that I want to, how do I even get involved, and isn't it too late for me? I spoke about this one woman that my sister and I met. We pulled into a Valero gas station while we were on the campaign trail, and when Jenny went in to pay the bill, the woman behind the counter saw her O'Donnell for U.S. Senate sticker and said, you know, tell your sister we're all rooting for her. And then she clearly articulated her frustration with politics as usual, the establishment both in Delaware and in the nation, and, you know, we need to return to the time when common sense values guided our legislative process. And my sister said, you know, well, you can do more than root for her. Don't forget to vote on November 2nd. And this woman's response was very telling. She said, almost embarrassed, oh, I'm not the type to get politically active. I'm not, you know, and almost in a shameful way, almost as if she was embarrassed, as if you had to be anointed and approved and asked formally to get involved. And yet this woman could very clearly articulate what her frustrations were, yet she wasn't registered to vote because she didn't think she was the so-called type. If you are a citizen and if you don't like what you see happening, you are qualified to get involved. And then that closing chapter, Apathy to Activism, talks about just the few steps you need to take, because so many of us, once we get over that mindset, we go, okay, now what? Now how do I get involved? What do I do? And it's a lot easier than you think. And I tried to lay it all out. For many, the beginning part of that chapter might be redundant, might be stuff you already know. But for many, you know, simply how to register to vote is brand new stuff. And it's empowering to realize that it's a lot easier than you think. And I love what you said about your political weapon is your voice. Your voice. Get out there, start speaking up, write letters to the editor, call into radio shows. This stuff can be very empowering and have a great impact.
Stan, thanks a lot for calling in. We wish you the best of luck with the Spartanburg Tea Party and your future efforts there. I know you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you for having me, and I look forward to hearing what others have to say.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Stan.
Thanks.
And now we are going to go to Alice in Houston, Texas. Alice, are you on the line?
I am. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi, Alice. Good to talk to you. Thanks for calling in this morning. You too, Christine. Thanks so much for taking my call. I was curious, what do you see your role being in the upcoming election? What do I feel? What was that?
Your role. How are you going to use your voice, as you talked about, and your stance, and what do you want to do in the upcoming election?
Well, in my race in 2010, the foreign press called me a leader in the second American Revolution. Now, that's a great and humbling honor to be considered a leader and a voice. And I hope to do exactly that, to continue to empower others to get involved and to continue to speak common sense conservative principles. I believe that not only is our country at a crossroads, but we as a movement, this second American Revolution, this middle class movement that is propelling the Tea Party, is also at a crossroads. We've got folks like my former senator and now our vice president, Joe Biden, calling us terrorists. We've got Maxine Waters saying we should all go to hell. We've got, you know, the Time magazine trying to say that this movement has passed its prime. None of that is true. But if we start acting like the extremists they're accusing us of being, and if we allow them to distract us from our real goal, then we will go past our prime. But if we keep our focus on why we're involved in the first place and remember that everybody has a sphere of influence, whether it's the folks you meet in the carpool lane, whether it's just, you know, the other parents at preschool, or whether it's the people at your workplace, or if you're a student, your other classmates, and it's about raising your hand and correcting your professor when they say something so politically incorrect that it's almost deceptive. Everyone has a sphere of influence, and that's how we're going to change and turn the tide in America, is by everyone speaking up and getting involved. And I wrote the book, Troublemaker, in order to be a clarion call and to help equip everyday Americans like yourself and like Stan, who just called. The closing part with the policy, why big government is wrong, why socialism has absolutely no place in an American economy. Why, if you want to help the little guy, you've got to help fight to return our country back to pure, common sense, free market principles. And one thing that we have to realize, as we find ourselves as a movement at the crossroads, we are hearing so much pressure to compromise. Don't be so, you know, dogmatic. And I say, don't listen to that, because first of all, to get our country back on track, we need to have an ideological reawakening of these principles that made our country great and will still keep our country great and will make our country great once again. And we as a movement need to be the force that's like dynamite exploding and powering through a mountain. That's how we're going to get through the mountain of corruption that lays before us. But we need to know why we stand for these principles, why these principles are what will make our country great again. And I tried to lay out what I hope is a convincing argument for all that. Our follower-in-chief, why Barack Obama is not capable of leading our country back towards recovery for another 4 years. I tried to lay out not just policy, but examples of where he has been a follower rather than a leader. And I tried to lay out a very convincing argument that many readers have told me helped them to go into their sphere of influence and start articulating why we need limited government and local control. So thank you. I appreciate that question. And I hope going into 2012, I can continue to be a voice and to inspire many who have never been involved in the political process to get involved themselves. I talked about also in the closing chapter how, you know, I was 21 and working as a youth delegate for the Bush Quail campaign, and I had never voted yet myself, you know, and here I was being used to influence so many of my students. And, you know, so we've got to break off this false mindset that you have to be of a certain, you know, wealth status or go to a certain school. All you have to do is care about our country and have the courage and convictions to stand up for the truth in your own God-given arena.
Alice, thank you so much for your call. I hope you guys can turn Harris County red again in 2012.
Oh, we're working on it.
It's up to you, Alice.
That's right. It's all on you.
It's all me. It's all up to me. No, it is.
I said that kind of kidding, but.
Oh, I know. I'm absolutely not a problem. You're right. We are working on that back down here in Houston, and I know my sister and I are going to be even more involved this next election year than we have been in the past and stuff. So definitely.
Well,
thanks for inspiring.
The big problem you guys had, if I recall, is that there was this large influx of people from Louisiana into Harris County after Hurricane Katrina, and that turned Harris County blue for the first time for as long as anybody can remember in 2008.
True. That is true.
Well, Alice, thanks once again for your call. Christine, did you have something else you wanted to say to Alice?
Oh, I was just going to congratulate Alice. You guys in Texas are doing some great work leading the way and being pioneers in fighting voter fraud. I know that you guys have had some great legislative battles, and stay encouraged. Even with an influx of blue into your county, remember that the other side needs to resort to deception and dirty tricks. But freedom is inscribed on everyone's heart. We don't need to compromise. If people aren't listening to our message or understanding why we believe in certain principles, we don't abandon the message. We reframe it and reach everybody in where they are. And I just encourage you to keep going because you guys are doing amazing work. And if I can just ask you real quick, who is your favorite in 2012 in terms of the Republican contenders?
Oh, gosh. There's different people for different reasons, quite honestly. So.
Yeah, me too. I'm right there with you, and that's why I like to hear what other people think. And I say everybody has their pros and everyone has cons. But
well, exactly. We're human beings. We're all flawed. We have our strengths and our weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I like Rick Perry, of course, as our governor. I've voted for him numerous times, and I think he's done a great job with the state of Texas. Of course, you know, do I agree with everything all the time? No, of course not. I like Herman Cain and his very succinct 999 plan and cutting the corporate mm-hmm. tax rates, and I think he does a great job with that. I'm so glad to see that he's kind of come to the forefront now in Florida in just the last week or so. So that's exciting to me to see. I mean, I like Michelle Bachmann again, being another empowered female out there really doing mm-hmm. well, having a great voice for the women and showing how smart and articulate women are out there. So absolutely, there's all kinds of, again, there's positives and negatives about all kinds of different people, and I'm really excited to see who ends up being with the nomination because I think we have a huge slate of great candidates who are certainly well-qualified and can get the job done. So those are my choices right now.
I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you, and I'd be very excited if any of the candidates who are standing on the stage won the nomination, because I think all of them would be true constitutionalists who are willing to defend our Constitution and bring our country back, stand up against establishment pressure. So I think that the fact that we have a slate of candidates, all of whom truly are independent thinkers, champions of the Constitution in their own right, is a real testimony to the power of the Tea Party movement.
Oh,
Alice,
absolutely.
You are so articulate. I think I just need to interview you sometime. That's fantastic.
You know, I was thinking the same thing, Mark, about you, Alice. I don't know if you've done a lot of talk radio, but I was thinking the same thing as you as you were speaking. You know, one of the things that many people can do that they forget that they've got this resource at their fingertips is call into talk radio almost on a daily basis. And I know especially in your area of Houston, there are so many talk radio shows that, you know, you could spend all day calling it, but it has such an impact. When a candidate goes on, the listeners expect them to say a certain message, and it has weight. But when the listeners themselves call in and repeat that message or make that argument or put out a soundbite or correct misinformation that the others are putting out there, it has so much more weight because, you know, people tend to listen to their neighbors more than candidates or companies that have an agenda or a paid spokesman. So, you know, Alice, you are very articulate, and one of the ways that you and other listeners can make such a difference is just get those talking points and dial in, dial for change.
Alice, you're welcome to call the Tea Party Power Hour anytime.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
Fantastic. We go next to Mara in California. Mara, it's pretty early where you are. Good morning.
Good morning.
What city in California are you in?
It's the Sacramento area, Northern California.
Ah, fantastic. What do you want to ask Christine this morning?
Oh, well, hi, Christine. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I also want to apologize to Christine. I haven't had a chance to read her books. I don't know if maybe she covered this topic anywhere in it. But I do a lot of research on conservative blogs and stuff and get my news from that more than I do TV. And I came across an article the other night about how easy it is to tamper with voting machines. And it had a video even that described how it's done. Apparently, all they need to do is just have access to the machine, maybe while it's being stored in a local school or someplace where they're about to use the machines, and if there's not that much security. And they can just implant this little chip that goes between the user and the motherboard where the information is being transmitted. And then with a remote control or even programming the chip itself that they implant, they can intercede between the user using the machine of what they want to send and what the people interceding want to the information to actually, you know, be changed to when sending to the machine or to the place to be counted. So in context of seeing that, and I also was following your race when you were running, along with all of the others, I kept seeing a lot of news articles, I think in Harry Reid's race and also in your race, where they were sending out emails to the Democratic Party, like, I need help, we need, you know, more people out there to vote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a sense that there was any kind of, because we all know the other side is pretty experienced in how to cheat. Did you get a sense that there was any voting cheating going on like that?
Absolutely. For example, one of the guys who was a poll captain working directly with the Department of Elections told us that the Department of Elections was reporting the results from his polling place before he had even submitted them. But I'll tell you, it can be overwhelming and you feel almost helpless, like, what can we do? But there is something we can do, and it's crucial that people start to make the change. We can pass legislation in our state requiring that we have photo IDs. Now the liberals are pushing back, saying that's racist, that's stereotyping.
Right.
You want to require someone to have a photo ID. Well, we had people who were our, you know, poll watchers tell us that someone would come in with a voter registration card saying that they were 65, and yet they looked no more than 20-something. Even if they looked young, you know, you can't
right.
be 60 and look like you're in your 20s. You can be 40 and look like you're in your 20s, but you can't be 60. So my response to that is, you need a photo ID to sign up for a welfare program. You need a photo ID to sign up for government assistance. How is it in any way prejudicial to require someone to have a photo ID to register to vote. You can also fight on your state legislature level to have these voting machines changed. We're doing that in Delaware. Right after the campaign, we started Christine PAC in order to continue the great work that was done through the campaign. I had one of our supporters say, we won every single one of our battles that we set out to in the O'Donnell for U.S. Senate campaign, except the detail of who's representing Delaware and Washington, because we busted up the backroom deal. We involved people who had never been involved in the political process before. We put important issues, the truth, into the spotlight, and we want to continue to do that. And one of the things that we're doing at Christine PAC is partnering with a group called True the Vote to have voter fraud prevention seminars. So that's something that you can do in California. It's something that, you know, got started in Texas, but it's a movement that's growing around the country, and it's happening very quickly and very rapidly in gearing up for 2012, because it is frustrating.
Yeah.
But we hold them accountable, and that's the key, is don't let the politics of personal destruction beat good people back to the sidelines. And that's their tactic right now. You know, that's what they did in my race. They threw all kinds of false claims against me so that headlines would read O'Donnell investigated by U.S. Attorney's Office. All those claims have been thrown out, but it's an intimidation factor because they have a victory twice. They win by maligning the character of their opponent, so the opponent loses on election day, but then also by doing that, they threaten good people like you and me and Mark and Alice and other callers before us. They bully us back to the sidelines, and we have to say enough is enough, bring it on. Truth and America is worth fighting for. So I'll take a couple beatings, but I'm not going to quit. That's the mentality that our founders have, and that's the attitude we have to have. But it is something that's out there. It's very hard to prove, but with a coordinated effort, it will be preventable.
Well, and just to let your listeners know, apparently in this video they said that if you suspect, like one of the telltale signs is if you're while you're voting, your screen blanks out, even if it's for like a split second.
Wow.
And they said that one of the things you can do, it was very informative. Everybody should, I saw it on The Blaze, and I think there's other websites that are featuring this, and they were saying it's only like a $10 piece of equipment that somebody can buy and put into these machines. And they said that if you suspect that the machine is has one of these devices in it, to insist on inspecting the internal part of the machine, because it can easily be seen, but nobody ever thinks to do that.
Right.
And it shows what to look for. So everybody should actually look for that video, too, as well, I think, as part of the activism,
right.
And insist on inspecting those machines.
Right.
But, I was very saddened by the race. I was following a multitude of races across the nation and rooting for all of the conservatives, and you were one of them, one of my heroes. And I even watched your debates, and I thought you were great.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
Well, Mara, I know it's early in California. We appreciate you getting up early and calling in, and we look forward to having you call back again sometime. That was a very, very well thought out question.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mara. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you.
And we go next to Karen Martin in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Karen, can you hear us?
I can. Hi, Mark. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing great. I also followed your race. I donated to your race, and it was a hard loss. But I do want to say that one thing I took away from your campaign, actually two things, is that for the first time, I think conservative Americans know what the NRSC is and how the NRSC is not on our side. And I think that your race in particular has dried up a lot of their funding, and people are donating directly to candidates. So I think that was a huge win. And then the other thing, in reading your book, you never understand how corrupt state GOP organizations can be. And it seems like in Delaware you had a particularly corrupt statewide organization. My question is, after your race and after it's been out there that the Delaware GOP state organization just isn't representing Republicans well, they're not representing the platform, has there been any effort to move on precinct reorganization or whatever it's called in your state to get more people involved at the precinct level so that eventually, you know, you can topple some of those rhinos at the top and really regain your party there in Delaware?
Absolutely, Karen, and that's, you know, that's the exciting thing. That's what I meant when I said that one of our supporters said that we won every battle we set out to, except the detail of who's representing us in Washington. We have people who have stepped up to be, we call them election district chairs. It's the same thing as a precinct captain. People who have stepped up to lead in their area who had never been involved in the political process until my race and who had never considered actually being a leader. I was recently at a bull roast in Delaware, and I can't tell you how many people, at least a half a dozen, shared with me that they now have leadership positions on their local level because of my race, because I encouraged them to get to step up and get involved. And, you know, this one woman said, I would have never thought of myself as a leader, as someone who could hold one of these positions. And we tend to not always see the best and potential in ourselves until someone else can speak of it, but why not? If you've got a heart for our country, for your local community, if you're willing to stand up for the truth and not compromise, then by all means, step up. And the great news is there was a movement right after my race to oust all those corrupt leaders, and all but one have been replaced. And this was something that happened organically. People just who were involved in the process were frustrated with such blatant corruption and blatant lies put out both by the Delaware GOP and the National Republican Senatorial Committee. But the great thing is they're learning the lesson, and more people are stepping up and getting involved and standing up for the truth. And I think that that's what's going to need to happen in order for us to win in 2012. And Frank Rich and Eric Erickson, so both a liberal and a conservative, credited my race for sort of distracting the tigers and letting other conservative candidates have it a little bit easier. You know, one of them specifically pointed to the scrutiny that Rand Paul and Marco Rubio were facing until my race popped onto the scene and sort of distracted them. They weren't picking on Rand Paul or Rubio as much because they were all busy picking on me. And that's, you know, it's an honor to have to consider that that was another role that I played. And we never know what the big picture is, but a lot of great came from 2012, and we need to continue to look at all the positives that came out. I meant 2010. And we need to continue to look at all the positives that came out in 2010 so that we can continue to have a victory in 2012.
Well, I agree with that phenomenon. In fact, I thought that same thing, and it might have been from reading one of their blogs, you know, that it's kind of like the whole the tide rising lifts all the boats. You know, the things that you were able to accomplish only just short of a Senate seat win in Delaware really gave a lot of spark and incentive and motivation to other parts of the country. So thank you for that. I also wanted to share with you that one thing that I do, every time you get those silly fundraising letters for the NRSC, I pull it out and I write across the place where you're supposed to put your money, I write Christ Castle Murkowski, and then I write a self-addressed stamped envelope and I mail it back to them and make them pay for it.
Good for you. Good for you. Message received. You know, I mean, that they should not be interfering in primaries, and we need to start putting up candidates again who are going to fight for the truth, because the reality is we're being pressured to compromise. But freedom is inscribed on everyone's heart. If our message isn't being received, you don't abandon the message. You reframe it so that it's resonating with everyday voters. Because, you know, again, the other side needs to resort to deception, needs to resort to dirty tricks. But what's going to get our country back on track is a radical ideological reawakening of the principles that made our country great. And it's this middle class movement, people who have never been involved in politics before, who are rising up and putting that outcry out there. The other thing we have to remember going into 2012, not to get discouraged, is no major advancement in our country happened because one person decided, oh, this, you know, George Washington didn't suddenly say, oh, you know, we should be independent, and then the next day it was. A whole generation before our founding was laying the groundwork. And then even after we won independence, I would argue that it wasn't until a generation after the founding of America that it was really solidified. And we have to remember that we are part of the second American Revolution, and we're going to win some battles and we're going to lose some, but we cannot give up until we are back on track to turning America back to the great beacon of hope that she once was.
Karen, I really appreciate your call today. Continued success with the Spartanburg Tea Party. I know you're recognized as one of the most effective tea parties in the United States, and I, you know, God bless you for what you do. Keep fighting the fight.
Thank you. Back at you.
God bless you, Karen.
And our last caller of the day is Joe from College Station, Texas. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. What's your question for Christine?
Good morning, Christine. I appreciate y'all taking my call.
No problem. Good morning, Joe.
I was first introduced to you, Christine, and you did your tour through Texas, in particular in Houston, Texas. I listened to two of your very strong radio interviews, and I was very impressed with how you held your ground and with some of their questions. So I wanted to start off with that. I remember, Christine, very vividly the 1994 midterm elections. And for me, it was quite exciting because I just recently got into listening to and figuring out what American politics was all about. I was about 30 at the time. And my question to you is, it's really two-part. First, can you describe how rewarding it felt to be one of the foot soldiers helping the Republicans win by your hard work with the rising tide? And the second part is, do you think there's any chance in heck that the conservatives have a chance of repeating 1994 in 2012?
Absolutely. Now, first let me say, Joe, thank you very much for your encouraging words. I very much appreciate them. But, yeah, I was working at the Republican National Committee in 1994, and I, too, was new into politics. I'd just gotten involved a couple years ago, and, you know, as I said in the book, you know, in 92, I was working as a youth delegate in the Bush Quail campaign and had never voted myself. And I shared that to encourage people that, you know, it doesn't matter if you've been involved before. Do you care now? And are you willing to step up and speak out now? It's never too late, and you don't have to, you know, be of a certain wealth status or have a certain Ivy League education in order to get involved. If you care and you're willing to do the work, you're willing to speak up to get involved. Now, in 94, I think one of the keys to our success, and this was Chairman Haley Barbour's creative initiative, and he's now the governor of Mississippi, but his vision was that we had to go directly to the people, and that's what the television show Rising Tide did, and it was my job to make sure that that show can be seen all over the country. So what we did was we worked with the local grassroots to mail them tapes, you know, super VHS and beta tapes. Now I'm dating not just myself, but this whole project. We sent them directly to the county coordinators, and then the county coordinators went to their local cable access channels and ran it on cable television. And usually there's this is a free service available for anyone who's a part of the community, or sometimes the fee might have been $20, but you go and you play the show that we were producing on the national level. Now,
what that did was it brought our message directly into the homes of the independent voters. You don't know how many people I would meet after that victory, people who were Democrats, people who had never voted Republican before, who told me that they would watch that show and that's what made them vote Republican. Now, we have the same exact means at our disposal right now, except even more. Information technology has made it so that the power is directly in the hands of the people. Now, we can produce videos with our iPhones nowadays. You can get that and run that show that you produce on your local cable access show. But you can also start a blog. We were talking to Alice, who's also from Texas, about calling into your radio talk show host. The way we're going to win in 2012 is by getting our message directly out to the people. And there are so many possibilities for activists like yourself, Joe. But it was exciting to see that major victory, and it sort of spoiled me a little bit because, you know, my first time involved in politics on such a, you know, hands-on way was such an amazing victory, you know, and we have to repeat that. But again, what we have to remember, the key ingredient to our success, to that historic Republican sweep in 94, was getting a solid message, the contract with America, a solid message directly to the people and spelling it out for them how this impacts your daily life. And it's very exciting to see that we have the potential to do that again.
That's wonderful. You know, it's amazing, from beta tapes to email now. Wow, technology.
Right? what used to take us, you know, the show would air live on satellite on Thursdays, and we would very quickly get that live broadcast dubbed and then stay till way past midnight stuffing these overnight envelopes so that they'd get them either you know, Saturday or the next Monday. Today, you can just upload that file, you know, put it on the site, or just hit send through an email, and it can all be done in an hour. It's amazing the advancements we've had, and it's exciting to see what groups like, you know, Mark's radio show and so many other Tea Party folks are doing to take advantage of that technology.
It is. Hey, Mark, do I have time for one more question?
You do indeed, Joe. Go ahead.
Great. Christine, one of the things that was very inspiring, actually, from your book was your story about your college. It's mm-hmm. similar to mine, and I thought that most Americans got through college in 4 years and had no loan balance. You know, I got through college in 6 years and had a huge loan balance and, you know, had very little help, went the junior college route and the small university route. Wow, that sounds familiar.
Right.
Anyway, my question to you is just how wonderful, you know, does it feel knowing that two people are alive today from a direct result of what you said years ago? One was the mother who didn't go through with her planned abortion, so that would be the child she birthed. And then the other was the one that did not commit suicide.
Right.
She got to need help from listening to you. How wonderful
right.
is that?
Yeah, and isn't it amazing how the things that we do for good, the things that make us real, the things that make us human, my political opponents try to use against me. In order to get our country back on track, you know, we need more everyday Americans, more real people who are willing to stand up for what is right. We need them engaged in the political process. Career politicians who have been groomed for office all their life have turned Congress into a favor factory. Real people have real problems. And the establishment tried to take the fact that, you know, it took me 10 years to pay off my college loans and make it something bad. You know, and we have to remember that these things that make us stronger, you know, it's our hardships that make us have, you know, more courage and strength to get through everyday situations.
that's what makes us better people, and they're the kind of people we need in Washington. So I'm glad that was able to resonate with you, because that's exactly why, you know, some of my political advisors said you might have been a little too honest about some of the stuff that you went through. But the reason I did it was because real people have real problems, and we cannot let the other side use anything against us. If you own up to it and you've tried to make it right, then take it as a badge of honor that you're part of a middle-class movement who are using our struggles to make us stronger, and they cannot let us, shame us back into the sidelines.
That's just very inspiring. I would just say thank you for keep telling that story to Middle America, because Middle America is, most people are experiencing those type of struggles.
Exactly, exactly. Well, thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Joe. Feel free to call in anytime you want. That's all the time that we have, and I just want to thank you for this idea. I want to share with my listeners that we were in the Woodlands, Texas. You were doing a book signing, and you suggested the book club idea to me, and we're going to do many more book clubs on the Tea Party Power Hour, thanks to your suggestion, and we'd like to have you back to do this again. It has been absolutely fantastic.
As always, Mark, you're doing great work for the country, so keep it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christine.
God bless you.
God bless you. My next guest is Shannon Gessling. She is the Executive Director and Chief Legal Counsel for the Southeastern Legal Foundation, a public interest law firm that has filed a lawsuit against the EPA in an attempt to keep the EPA from regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Shannon, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate you having me back on.
Last time you were here, you were telling us all about various legal efforts that the Southeastern Legal Foundation was making to keep the EPA from regulating CO2 as a pollutant. Update us. What's going on?
Wow, so much has gone on since the last time, but to put a fine point on it, last time we talked, we were talking about Climate Gate, which is the controversy that everybody remembers, and basically the fraud was afoot in the whole greenhouse gas and climate change scientific and political community that resulted in these regulations. And now, as of the 28th, you've got the Inspector General's report that just came out that basically says that the EPA didn't follow the rules for this gargantuan regulatory effort. So that's pretty exciting, and we put a little bit of the writing on the wall in our last talk, and now it's going to result in some hearings on the Hill, and maybe put the administrator of the EPA in a little bit more hot water, exactly where she deserves to be.
Well, a lot has happened since your last visit, and I may be getting the timeline wrong, but if I'm not mistaken, the Chicago Climate Exchange closed after your last visit. We have seen the cap-and-trade bill gasp its last breath in Congress, at least I hope it has, and you know, now we have the Inspector General coming out with this finding. It seems like our side is winning. Is that just wishful thinking on my part, or am I onto something?
I think it's a little bit of wishful thinking, but you're on to something at the same time. It's that the last resort that we have right now, and it's not where we should be, is the court and the D.C. Circuit, because the president and the administration and his EPA have, in fact, passed these rulemakings and put them into place, and it's going to cost us to the tune in the next decade of about $1 trillion and between 4 and 10 million jobs. So that's the damage that's being done, and it's ongoing. Now, how we stop it and what other things have actually come out, that's a different question. And to the extent that we're able to stop them through this litigation, that's what we're doing. Now, you know, we filed suit in late 2009, early 2010, 4 cases. They got all kind of consolidated. But really, most people don't know that the type of case that it is, rather than like a trial, it's like an appeal. So everything's done in writing. If that can be more boring to listeners, I don't know what is. But talk about, hundreds of pages of briefing and thousands of pages of a record, and you're trying to communicate to a court, 3-judge panel, that what the Environmental Protection Agency is doing is unlawful, it's circumventing Congress, it's circumventing the intent of the Clean Air Act. They're not following their own rules, and we're basically screaming it from the top of our lungs on an 8.5 by 11, you know, piece of paper.
One of the things that's always been a little curious to me regarding ClimateGate, and maybe as an attorney you can share some, or shed rather, some light on this, is that the talking points coming out of the CRU in England were spread throughout America, and we saw professors from various universities. In fact, I am in College Station, Texas, right near Texas A&M University, and we had one of our climate guys, who is a big proponent of anthropogenic global warming, go on Fox and say, oh, you know, using Mike's nature trick, you know, in scientific circles, a trick is just a very clever way of doing something. You're like, hey, that's a neat little trick. There was nothing there that demonstrated fraud. But as a layperson, my question is, well, you're only looking at half the quote. Within what context would using Mike's nature trick to hide the decline be anything less than academic fraud? So my thought is that we really do have the smoking gun. I mean, these are some of the top climate proponents, or climate, how can I put this, the top anthropogenic global warming proponents in the world, very high ranking within the UN IPCC, very instrumental in controlling what does and does not get into various journals, admitting behind the scenes that they had to use a trick because they didn't want people to realize that the Earth's climate was actually declining. Now, am I reading too much into that, or can you explain away the word trick and the word hide?
Yeah, look, they were caught red-handed. Your perception is correct. And instead of being what any little girl, little boy would do when they had their hand in the cookie jar and saying, you've caught me, I'm sorry, instead, they have gone some intellectual academic route that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter whether you're a lawyer or a layperson, Mark. It's absurd, that kind of remark. It's absurd that they're trying to explain it that way. Their intent is obvious. What they were doing is clear when you read through all of those emails from University of East Anglia, ClimateGate, AmazonGate, HimalayaGate. It's exactly what we perceive it to be. It is exactly what the public knows it to be, and that is that they are committing these intellectual and academic frauds to the detriment of the financial well-being and environmental well-being of the United States and probably every other country on the planet, flat out, because they have an agenda. And the President of the United States and his EPA has joined that group, and that's what we're fighting. Because it's exactly what we thought it was. It's exactly what you read. There isn't any explanation for it. And don't buy into some, you know, somebody who has an agenda that is, selling ice to Eskimos. We just don't need it. We're not buying into it.
Well, what was interesting about Gerald North from Texas A&M is that after he went on Fox, and somehow I think he might have also been called in as an expert at Penn State regarding this issue, he admitted that he hadn't read any of the emails. After the Fox interview, he said he just couldn't bring himself to look at them. During the whole Penn State affair, he said he didn't read them out of professional courtesy to the other scientists. So he couldn't even keep his story straight regarding why he hadn't read the emails. Now, there were some alarming things in those emails, in addition to saying that they had used a nature trick. And let's go ahead and say what the trick is. The proxy data being used by Michael Mann was tree ring data. But when the proxy data began to show a decline in temperatures, that didn't really fit their agenda. So surface station data, which, by the way, is very incomplete and very inaccurate, was substituted right about that point where you see the hockey stick shoot up and actually make the shape of a hockey stick. That's right. Surface station data. Prior to that, we saw tree ring data. And I have yet to have a scientist explain to me, and I've actually asked a few that support global warming, what was it about that tree ring data that just became so tainted, so bad, at the point where Michael Mann chose to submit instead surface station data, other than the fact that the tree ring proxy data wasn't showing you what you want? And I've yet to have anybody explain to me what was so bad about that tree ring data at the point where Michael Mann chose to substitute surface station data. In all of your exploration for this litigation, have you found a reason that they're offering?
It doesn't give them the outcome that they want. It's just that simple. I mean, this is really what we're this is what we're talking about. And when I was talking a little bit about the Inspector General report that came out, what we perceive is that there is a lot going on behind the scenes. They are motivated to regulate. They have an agenda. The global warming alarmists, the Al Gore types, and let's face it, he did an outstanding public relations campaign, but it's falling apart because we're learning the truth. Now, they don't want us to learn the truth, but we're learning the truth. And now, with the Inspector General's report that just came out, that speaks volumes that you now have a government actor investigating how a government agency is doing business and making a finding that they're not doing things the way that they're supposed to do. And this is where it's important for our case, if you don't mind me kind of bringing it kind of full circle from your global view to what are we doing in this case. And it's,
no, I want to hear it.
Today, we are going to be filing a motion with the court to ask the court to take judicial notice of the Inspector General's report and that record, and add it to our record on the case. And down the road, depending on how, if the hearings on the Hill, whether we can get transcripts of those hearings, we may add those to the record. Because what the EPA has done, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're saying that we don't have to use our judgment in declaring greenhouse gases unsafe. We get to rely on this technical support data. But then they tell the court, right, they say one thing to the Inspector General, and then they tell the court we're using the administrator is using her judgment in making this finding. So which is it? Is it that there is indisputable evidence that there is anthropogenic global warming that can be addressed by a regulatory scheme? Or is it that you're using your judgment in making that determination? Which is it? And we've got two different answers to two different bodies, and one of them isn't true.
Yeah.
And that should scare the American people. And it doesn't matter whether you believe in anthropogenic global warming or you don't. What should scare you is the political maneuvering by this administration contrary to the financial well-being of the United States, that there is a goal set and they are going headlong to commit to it and accomplish their goal, and it doesn't matter what happens to the American people. That's a problem. And that's a problem because you shouldn't care whether you know something is whether it's part of your belief system or not. Your government is supposed to do right by you at all times, and this government isn't.
You've made a couple of references to the EPA's agenda. Define for us what you think that agenda is.
That's easy. That's undermining manufacturing, socialization, transfer of wealth, taxation without representation. It's your worst nightmare. That's what the agenda is. It's your worst nightmare. Hardworking people paying for people who aren't going to work hard. Undermining. Basically, what the president talks about is the rich paying for everybody else. Undermining the ability to manufacture in this country. These regulatory policies and the policies of each and every agency as directed by this administration is undermining the economic well-being of this country. Like we needed any help. I mean, he is pushing so that manufacturing leaves the United States altogether, that none of us is going to be able to afford energy. It is just damaging upon damaging upon damaging, and we're already fighting. Each one of us is fighting to keep our heads above water, pay our bills, and you've got an administration who acts as if those things aren't a reality. I mean, where is his loyalty? Is it to the United States? Is it to the well-being of this country? The EPA is just an example, another example of a power grab by the Obama administration, very similar to his health care plan.
Now,
if you talk to my friends who are doing the same kind of work all over the country, public interest work, every single federal administration, every federal administrative agency is running amok on enforcement and interpretation of regulations and is damaging small businesses, big businesses, and individuals flat out.
I'm sure the people at Gibson Guitar would agree with you.
I know that reference. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things, again, I'm a common sense guy. I mean, I have a college degree, but I'm a common sense guy. I don't think of myself as being this super academic, super intellectual type. I just like to apply common sense to things. And one of the things I've noticed is in my research about this is that the New York Times is not a scientific journal, but at the same time, it does a good job of gauging the opinions of various industrial groups, academic experts, et cetera. And if you go back and look at a 150-year history of the climate vis-a-vis the New York Times, what you're going to find is that the scientific community has flip-flopped at least a dozen times, and that's a generous underestimate, on whether the planet was heating and about to boil over or freezing and about to go into another ice age. They can't seem to make up their mind, and about every 20 to 30 years, we flip. And there's
That's right.
Yeah,
look back at Newsweek and Time in the 70s.
I was about to say, I was a small boy in the 70s, and I still remember turning on the television on Saturday mornings and hearing Christopher Glenn with his little In the News segment saying that the Earth was headed into an ice age. Now, much like now, they weren't opposed to scaring little kids back in the 70s to tell them they should tell their parents to do something about the coming ice age. And it seems like if it's heating a little bit or it's cooling a little bit, according to the scientific community, the blame falls on mankind, and the answer is to tax business. So my thought is, if you want to solve global warming, the cheapest way to do it might be to simply hold off, do nothing, and wait until the scientists change their minds again.
You know, that's a funny thing. Do you know why that you keep seeing the change?
No.
Grant money. Sure, it's grant money. That's my theory. It's grant money. This is why they changed, because what happened to acid rain, right? They ran out of grant money. What
right.
happened to global cooling? They ran out of grant money, or they ran out of dollars that were coming in from various entities to pay them for their expertise. So now we need the newest and greatest potential tragedy to humankind. So you get a good grant, and you know, you write a good grant application, and you get millions of dollars to do your research and make your declarations. And you know, the scary part is that they're being bought. You know, this administration has bought it hook, line, and sinker. When I was talking about kind of what was scary, do you realize that the EPA has admitted that all of these regulations that I just said that were going to cost about $1 trillion over the next 10 years and 4 to 10 million jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that they admit in their declarations that there is no measurable improvement in global temperatures with all of these regulations?
Well, One of the reasons for that is that China and India have basically told us we can go jump in a lake when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. And one of the things I found interesting, you know how indebted we are as a nation to China. One of the things that's been proposed is that the United States pay China to retrofit many of its power plants, its coal-powered power plants, to be more environmentally friendly in terms of the amount of CO2 being released. So that literally would mean that we're going to have to borrow money from China to give to China to get them to retrofit these factories. If that's not ridiculous, I don't know what is.
It is ridiculous. And then the unindustrialized countries want to be paid for them to keep from industrializing. But the reality is that India and China are not going to alter the fact that they are headlong in the middle of their industrial revolution. There is nothing that's going to stop that. And please explain to me how, if this is a world problem or a global problem, it makes any sense whatsoever. And let's just assume for a moment that there is global warming. Please explain to me how the United States can solve a global problem without incorporating the global community. It's an impossibility. And as an impossibility, if you cannot solve a problem by yourself, that's assuming there is a problem. And, of course, I don't assume there's a problem, so then it makes it even more absurd that we're going to have regulations that are not impacting Europe or Asia or Africa. We are the ones who are acting. So that's bizarre at best. And, you know, I keep coming back to what damage it does to America and Americans and the manufacturing community and the corporate community. That's where we live. This is how are we going to survive the damage that is being done by this administration and this Environmental Protection Agency? That's a serious question.
Well, one of the things that I like to do, and I have a long history of being a salesperson, one of the things that we were taught in every sales class I've ever taken is that whenever you're trying to sell someone an idea, you give them the whiffum, the what's in it for me. Maybe we should consider it the what could happen to you. But I think if you were to grab a camera and a microphone and go around and just go into a den of liberals if you have to, ask them if they would be willing to let their monthly electric bill quadruple in order to affect the planet's temperature by 1 degree Celsius over the next 100 years, and ask them if they would be willing to do that. Because that is essentially what the Greens are asking people to do. Barack Obama, in his own words, said that under his cap-and-trade plan, electric bills would necessarily skyrocket. That's Barack Obama. So how many people out there?
And forget about going into the den of liberals. Go into the communities that are the poorest. Can they afford for their electric bill to skyrocket? You and I, it's going to go up. Maybe it's going to skyrocket. We're going to grin and bear it. We're going to be able to make that payment. What about the people who can't? And the liberals aren't speaking for them. And the people who are showing up at the rallies aren't those people. It's the people who are living in a studio apartment in an urban area with two kids who are trying to make it. It's people living in a rural community who are just making it. If you're just making it now, how are you going to make it if your electric bill skyrockets? You are
excellent.
Not. So
excellent.
The liberals are not answering. They're not going to answer in the affirmative. They're not going to say that they're not going to be able to pay their bill. Those activists aren't going to be concerned because they are going to be able to pay the bill. You and I are going to be able to pay the bill. It's the people that are the poorest in this country that aren't going to be able to pay their bill, and the jobs that they had with manufacturing that are now going to China and India are going to disappear, and it's going to get worse.
Let me throw a little more common sense at you. One of the things that I'm aware of is that commercial greenhouses actually pump CO2 into their greenhouses because of the numerous beneficial impacts that it has on plant life. And let me list a few of those. You tend to have bigger plants, healthier plants, plants that are more heat resistant, plants that need less water, plants that produce larger, healthier, juicier fruit. That's what CO2 does for plants, and that's why commercial greenhouses are willing to pay to pump that into their greenhouses. It doesn't make any sense to me from a common sense standpoint that something we exhale as humans and something that is so valuable to plant life that commercial greenhouses are willing to spend money pumping it into their greenhouses could be listed as a pollutant. It sounds like something that's just so beneficial that the word pollutant could never be applied to it. Talk to me about that.
If I had an answer to that, we probably wouldn't be in the middle of this litigation, and we probably wouldn't be horrified by the conduct of the Obama administration. You've said it clearly and concisely, and you're just, darn it, Mark, you're right. It makes no sense. This is why sometimes I feel like it's, you know, Twilight Zone. Why am I having a conversation about something being called a pollutant that I know, not just common sense, not because I'm a lawyer, not because I'm in the public interest community, because I know it's not a pollutant. I learned it in elementary school. It is not. It is beneficial to plant life to have carbon dioxide. Without it, you have no plant life. You have no life on Earth. So it makes no sense. And that, you know, let me be frank. That is why that the general population gets it. About 3 years ago, it started to shift, the understanding of the general public about this, that the campaign, the Gore campaign to convince the world that there was anthropogenic global warming and that we had to do something about it, it was at its height. And they were doing an outstanding job for a media campaign. It wasn't a science campaign. It was a media and political campaign, and they were at their height. They have now declined. The dollars they're spending to convince the American people and the world that they're right are falling on deaf ears. More and more people see that it is just a huge fraud, endeavored for self-benefit for Al Gore and or for an agenda by the environmentalists. And that agenda is detrimental to the well-being of the American people, large or small companies, individuals or groups. liberal or liberal Democrat or conservative Republican, it doesn't matter. That agenda is damaging. We now get it, and we're basically not going to tolerate it. And that's why we have this lawsuit, and that's why the Inspector General's report is getting attention. That's why the United States Supreme Court, hopefully in the next 2 years, is going to solve it. And let's be honest, let's hope that we don't have an administration in the next 2 years that is going to, you know, have this type of attitude toward something that is not only an untruth, but the efforts that they're making in pursuit of the untruth are pointless.
Do you think it's going to ultimately be beneficial to Governor Rick Perry that he has decided to come out and be extremely honest on this issue and call it what it is? Because it seems to me that in an attempt to damage Perry, and of course we've got people on that stage like Mitt Romney and Huntsman who think that global warming is real, but because the vast majority, well not the vast majority, but I think over 50% now realize that this is nonsense, do you see that helping or hurting Perry as we head into the primaries?
Well, you know, I can only speak as an individual, you know, part of the electoral population. I'm very pleased that a candidate for President of the United States is speaking honestly and forthrightly about the absurdity of anthropogenic global warming. And it's refreshing. I hope that, you know, I hope that we continue to hear that kind of message because the endeavor that is being pursued by the alarmists is to usurp power outside the Constitution and strip the wealth of this country. And that is, I'm sorry, but that's just straight up scary. And we need to have leadership speaking directly to those issues. And we need somebody in the White House that's going to answer our questions and be honest. And it's nice to hear somebody who can speak about it knowledgeably and know what damage is being done to our country.
Well, it's interesting to me to watch how Team Green will spin things. Did you get a chance to look at Joe Rahm's take on the Inspector General's comments?
I did.
I mean, he's basically saying that all it shows is that there was $300,000 wasted to say that the EPA is doing the right thing.
You know, it's funny. You read that report, and this teardown, if you will, is such a spin. The United States spends money every day in staggering numbers, and we do good things and we do not so good things. We all have our opinions about that. But I've not actually seen somebody question the fact that an inspector general who investigates the conduct of a federal agency is a waste of dollars, especially when there are findings by that inspector general of wrongdoing and basically some intellectual fraud and possibly some political fraud that certainly is going to be answered through those the committee hearings on the Hill. If there was nothing in this report, then Senator Inhofe and others wouldn't be so interested in inviting Administrator Jackson up on the Hill to have her sworn in under oath and speak to the inconsistencies of her actions and the agency's actions. So feel free to spin it, but I'm wondering how long can the global warming alarmists spin things until they get dizzy and fall down? Because that's what they're doing. I mean, really. I mean, we get it. It's silliness. They're costing us money. They're costing us time. This is not how, you know, this isn't how Southeastern Legal Foundation should be spending its time, right? Okay. Fighting in something absurd that has no basis in fact, no basis in science, and has no possibility of actually providing any benefit to the well-being of the American people, and we're going to have to fight that. But that's what we do. That's what, you know, that's what Southeastern Legal Foundation does. You have to fight the issues that are before the American people, and that's what we're here for. And we intend to stick it out all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. We're going to speak about it publicly. We're going to argue it in court, and we'll wear them down if nothing else.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about all of this is that the Team Green people like to say, well, okay, so what if we're wrong? It's better to be safe and sorry when you consider the enormous amount of, you know, calamity that's going to take place on planet Earth if we don't do something. I mean, when you consider the potential threat, even if we're wrong, you know, in terms of the precautionary principle, it's better to do something now. And to me, they've always seemed to look the other way on how people are being hurt right now, not from global warming, but from belief that we have to stop global warming from the efforts of the environmentalists. For example, because of the ill-guided biofuel attempts to solve this problem, we had people starving in Mexico. I mean, I'm in Texas right now, and nobody in Texas knows that there was something called the tortilla riots in Mexico because so much agricultural land was being used to grow fuel for cars instead of food for people. The world price of corn doubled, and that meant a lot of really, really poor people could no longer afford to buy corn to make tortillas from, and so they were rioting because they could no longer afford to eat. That's not global warming causing a problem. That's belief in anthropogenic global warming causing a problem right now. And there's so many places around the world where people burn dung to cook and burn dung in order to stay warm. And the environmentalists have filed a ton of lawsuits so that they can't build a coal-powered power plant in those areas. I mean, there are just so many people suffering around the world, but financially, people starving because environmentalists won't keep their nose out of other people's business. And one of the, I'm sure you're familiar with Joe Nova down in Australia. And Joe did a report showing that the U.S. government, I think since 1986, has spent $79 billion on global warming research. How many homes for the poor could have been built? How many poor people could have been helped? How many children could have been fed? How many people could have been educated with that money? Instead, we tinkled it away on a non-existent problem. My reason for thinking that all of this needs to stop and for saying that everything you're doing is extremely important is when you look at the foregone opportunity cost of having spent that money, having spent human resources, having spent that mental effort in another area.
Yes, I think about that every day. Is that the cost to the well-being of the American people because of the misguided principles and priorities. And I call it misguided because environmentalists, for a time, and I'm looking way back, had the right priorities. It was making sure that there was clean water and clean air and our land was protected and we were able to produce food. And there wasn't anybody that could dispute that there was a pull to find a balance in this country. But they have now become misguided. They want control over all of our resources rather than encouraging the people and the corporations of this country to value our limited resources of the planet and to encourage the type of positive growth. They don't want growth. They want industrializing countries to not industrialize. They want countries that are already industrialized to pay money for people to stop. I mean, just list all of the absurd things that are the consequences of pursuing this goal. I mean, and again, you have to go to premised on the fact that they would actually think that it's a real problem. And I'm not convinced that they actually believe it is a real problem.
I think they make
excuses for their priorities and their goals to undermine basically the foundation of this country.
I think a lot of what we see happening in the environmental movement is a result of what happened when all those anti-Vietnam, anti-war hippies didn't have anything else to do, so they moved into what at the time was called the ecology movement. The ecology movement was a pure movement. Those people cared about the environment. The anti-war hippies that got involved politicized the movement. And I think that's what we're seeing now is what happens when left-wing politics takes over a genuine environmental movement. It's amazing to me that Governor Perry had asked for everyone to pray for rain in Texas, and he was, basically attacked. And people said, well, he believes in magic, all for asking people to pray to a Christian God. But whenever they had that climate conference down in, I believe it was Cozumel, Mexico, they opened the darn thing with a prayer to the moon goddess. And I personally think that a lot of the environmentalists today are worshiping some kind of a really sick green religion. And if I'm not mistaken, one court even said that belief in global warming was a religion. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, that's funny you should say that. That's true. But, don't don't throw people into the movement that aren't part of it. I mean, there's no single generation. Excuse me. There's no single generation, and there's a lot of people that were interested in that time period that you're talking about that don't buy into any of this, that absolutely don't, that totally get the fraud of it all, and that this is about control of our resources and undermining the priorities that we've set as the American people and setting new priorities and a socialization that is not part of the movement that you're talking about. So there's an entire generation of people that participated in that time period that are now 100% on board with the activities of Southeastern Legal Foundation and the like to adjust and to fight this type of campaign led by the likes of the Obama administration, Administrator Jackson, Al Gore, and the global warming alarmists. I just have to reiterate, it is a fight worth fighting. It is a fight that we will win in the end, whether we win it in the court of public opinion or the court of law. We are right. They make mistakes. They don't only make mistakes, but the frauds that they commit get exposed. We believe they will continue to be exposed, and we believe there will be scientists that will continue to come out and switch sides and be on board with the efforts of Southeastern Legal Foundation and other organizations that will continue to disclose the inconsistency, the untruth, and the fact that these positions are not based on science. They're based on politics and motivated by a political agenda.
We're almost out of time. In the short time that we have left, can you tell other people that would like to get on board and help you in your efforts how they can support the Southeastern Legal Foundation?
Oh, I would love to. Thank you for asking. Southeastern
Sure.
Legal Foundation is a charitable organization, 501c3. We function 100% on contributions from individuals, organizations, and the corporate community. We do not receive any government funding. Our website is southeasternlegal.org, and we also have a dedicated website specifically for our global warming litigation project, including our suit against the EPA, and that is epalawsuit.org. And both of those websites provide information on contributions, but it also gives you updates on all of the good works about Southeastern Legal Foundation generally and all of the updates on the activities for this litigation that we expect to finish briefing this year, oral argument early next year, and hopefully before the United States Supreme Court in the next 18 months.
Well, it's certainly a worthy cause for everyone out there, if for nothing else, who doesn't want to see their monthly electric bill skyrocket. It might be better to purchase an ounce of prevention instead of a pound of cure later on. So I would encourage everyone to get on those websites and show Shannon how much you appreciate the work that the Southeastern Legal Foundation is doing on our behalf. Shannon, it is always a pleasure to have you here. I hope you'll come back again and give us an update as things progress.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, Mark.
Thank you, Shannon. That is all we have time for today. I want to remind everyone to tune in next week, and my guest will be Simon Atkins, basically the only meteorologist in the country who got Hurricane Irene right. He is a big opponent of Al Gore and believes that global warming, or at least man-made global warming, is nonsense. Tune in next week to find out why. Also, want to remind all you Tea Partiers out there in the Houston area that Herman Cain will be coming to the Barnes & Noble in the Woodlands on October the 8th. To get more information on how you can participate, give them a call at 281-465-8744. There's a good chance I'll see you there. Until next time, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.